Hello?
Hello?
Hi, it's Tamar.
Hello? It's Connie.
Hi, Connie. Thanks for joining us. I'm sorry, you were probably here 10 minutes ago, and I'm late. Thanks for joining us.
That's
thanks
okay.
For being here. I'm so sorry.
Good morning, Tamar. It's Jenna.
Hey, Jenna. How are you? So
hey,
at least you two guys could talk.
Hey,
so at least I wasn't that rude. Oh, you guys are talking to each other now. I'm so sorry, Connie, and it's early for you. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I'm an early bird.
Sounds like people are joining at a clip. Hello, everyone. We're just gathering. Thanks so much. Anne, are you with us yet?
I am. Good
Great.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Let's give people just a moment more, 60 seconds kind of, and then we'll go around and see who's here. We got Connie. We got the two important people, so the three important people, including Jenna. Okay, well, let's give them a few more seconds. So, hello everyone, it's Tamar Jacoby, thanks for joining us. Let's figure out who we have. We're going to start promptly because we have two busy guests. Let's go around the phone and figure out who's here. Just to avoid everyone speaking at once, if you're in the first third of the alphabet, let's say it goes up to H, why don't you tell us if you're here?
Drew Schneider, ABC.
You're an S, Drew. You're the last third of the alphabet. It's okay. I'm teasing. Thanks for being
first
here.
Name.
Okay. Well, let's do last name if you're in the first third of the alphabet. Are you here? Just so everyone doesn't talk at once.
Dan Belcher, NCCER.
Jenna Hamilton, HBA, Central Arizona.
Okay.
Laura B., Fairview Health Services, Minneapolis.
Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Ann, you're here. Okay.
Hi, right up AMP and NRCA.
Thanks. Hi, Craig. Okay, let's move into the next. We had a few people missing, but let's move into the next. Let's go all the way down to Drew, all the way down to the S's. Who else is not with us? Drew, I know you're here.
Jared
Nagurka. Jared. Hi, Jared.
I'm McLaughlin Haskell.
McLaughlin Haskell. Okay, thanks for joining.
John Rico, Chicago.
Hi, John.
Dwayne Musser and Terry Dorn with NRCA.
Hi, Dwayne. Who just joined?
This is Laura O'Neill with NSSGA. Not sure if my voice was recorded.
Thanks for joining us. So who's at the end of the alphabet?
Kelly Tran with ASD.
I'm sorry. Kelly, I got you.
Okay, great.
Got you, Connie.
Okay,
I'm not going to do that again. That was way too complicated.
Jim Young.
Hi, Jim. Okay. Great group. Thank you. Oh, hi. Thanks. Hi, Jason. Great. Okay, thanks, everyone, for joining us. There's a few little stragglers, but let's get started. So we have not, as a coalition, talked very much about the Ways and Means Committee. We've talked about them a little bit, but we focus mostly on Ed and Workforce, as you all know. But the Ways and Means Committee has been working our issue for quite a few months now, having a set of hearings that have been designed to kind of make the case, set up the narrative, tell the story of worker shortages and employers' woes. I was going to say desperation, but I decided it was a big word for early in the morning. Employers difficulties finding workers as a predicate to reform of the nation's biggest welfare program, TANF. And now the committee has introduced a discussion draft of a TANF reform, and indeed it's a real bill now. It's been actually introduced. And we talked about it a little bit at the last coalition meeting, but in case some of you weren't there, I'm just trying to set it all up so you know what we're talking about. I believe you're going to a markup tomorrow. Is that right, Ann?
That's correct.
All right. So markup tomorrow for this bill, which is, you know, we reformed welfare 20 years ago, 21, 22 years ago, but it's been a long time, and it's time, and it was a good idea then, getting more people to work. You know, how reforms go after 22 years, a lot of the good things get, you know, worn down and they need refreshing. So this is a new reform of our biggest welfare program. And it's important for us because it will bring some new workers into the workforce. You know, I'm channeling, you know, an employer. I know that there are going to be some employers who are going to embrace this with open arms and say, oh my gosh, great, a new workforce. And there are going to be some who are going to say, former welfare recipients, can they really work for me? You know, is that going to work out? Are they going to stay on the job? Are they going to be good workers? So, we thought on this call we would have, Ann, I always butcher your name. How do you pronounce your last name?
Ann DeCesaro. Ann is good.
Ann DeCesaro, from the committee, and Connie Wilhelm, who is the president and CEO, chief executive officer, of the Home Builders Association of Central Arizona, who's been doing really interesting work with a challenging population, not in her case, not quite welfare recipients, but former prisoners, former offenders. I'm not sure what the politically correct term is, but something like that. So I thought we have them both here to give us an overview of the bill and what it could mean for employers. And then Connie will talk about how she's made this work and, you know, how to think about, answer some of our hard questions about how to think about the challenges of trying to hire a workforce like this, the challenges and the value, I dare say. So, Ann, the floor is yours. Tell us about the bill.
All right. Well, first of all, I really appreciate everyone getting on the phone. It's really great to connect with employers. I know folks often overlook our subcommittee, which is actually the Human Resources Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. You know, if they do know Ways and Means, they know it for trade and tax and maybe health. But we are a mighty little subcommittee over here, you know, working on low-income populations and how to help those families succeed. And we have. I mean, I want to thank Connie. She appeared at our first hearing in our series on jobs and opportunity. And Brian, who she brought along as one of the program participants, he's not directly a TANF recipient, but had he had a child or any of the population that she serves that has children, they would be eligible, both under current law and under this bill, for the types of kind of soft skills and return to work efforts that we're trying to target. We call for those, most of them are non-custodial parents probably coming out of prison, meaning they don't have custody of their kids, but those are individuals who are also eligible for help under this. So to just kind of touch
on. And when you say soft skills and return to work efforts that you're trying to target, you mean trying to encourage and get states to provide, right?
Yes. So, yeah, I'll get into a little bit of what I mean, but I want to first recognize the fact that we have been trying to listen to employers. You know, post-tax reform, we see the unemployment numbers, we see the jobs opening numbers. We've been hearing directly from employers. That's part of what our Jobs and Opportunity Hearing Series was. We had 19 different witnesses from all sectors and all industries, doing creative things to bring workers into the workforce so that they could fill orders, they could, you know, continue on with their business to meet the demands that they have so that they can keep growing. So, you know, we also know that we have low labor force participation. We've focused a lot on kind of the 7 million men who are missing from the labor force. It ties into opioids as well. And so what we're trying to do as Tamar pointed out, you know, there's already a promise and funding from the 1996 welfare reforms to engage and to help individuals who are not in the labor force with children, but it no longer meets the demand of our modern economy or workforce. So we have the Jobs for Success Act, which is Jobs and Opportunity with Benefits for Success Act, that restores that promise by targeting the nearly $30 billion in funds spent through this program to help Americans enter and remain in the workforce. The bill revitalizes the focus on work by targeting dollars to meet families where they are in addressing the challenges in their lives and by providing work support such as child care and transportation they need to be successful in a job. We know that in the current economy, fueled by tax reform, potential workers need additional supports and preparation. They need someone who has their back that can coach them and link them to the resources they need. This is what the jobs dollars are redesigned to do. It's a win-win for America. Employers get the workers they need to grow their businesses, and parents get the support they need to get in and remain in the workforce to support their families. So quickly, I'll just run through a little bit more in detail of what the bill does. So there's kind of one, two, three, four, like five main things that the bill does. One, it ensures no one gets ignored or left behind by expecting universal engagement and case management. While in 1996, the effort was really aimed at single mothers and getting them back into the labor force, we're really trying to refocus this to be mothers and fathers, whether they're in the household or not, recognizing that the income that they can provide to benefit children and improve their outcomes for the long term. Make sure that states are focused on real outcomes. So it changes the mechanism that states are held accountable and applies kind of a pay-for-outcomes model where states will be held accountable for getting people into jobs and then keeping them in jobs, which is not really a focus of the TANF program right now. Chairman Brady talks about how it's not until kind of like 4 or 5 months in that maybe somebody realizes, wow, this work thing is kind of hard. Child care falls through or their car breaks down and or they've got people around them who say, like, why are you doing this? And so it's that kind of retention part that we think TANF should be there to help you as employers retain employees. The next one is it helps poor families, those that need the funds most, by requiring funds to go to those under 200% of the poverty line. So for a family of three, that's about $41,000 a year. Right now, states are diverting a lot of these funds for pet projects or for higher incomes. And it was kind of startling to see in our hearing series that no one mentioned TANF as like a source of support or resource. So our members were like, hey, we gave you, there's $30 billion in the system. What are you doing with it? So that's part of this is taking those dollars and saying, hey, you really need to focus on low-income households, those with no income or very little income, and engage them in work and not just plug state budget holes or fund pet projects. Again, it uses funds to support work, including additional access to child care and job training, allows for a transfer for the first time into the workforce system. Many of you know, through your work with Ed and Workforce, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act allows a transfer to that, hopefully strengthening the connection between the TANF program and the workforce system. It also allows for combined state plans and allows them to use common exit measures. It also, the outcome measures that TANF will be using are mirrored and based on those used in the workforce system. And then kind of finally, it promotes innovation, transparency, and, again, the program coordination that I just talked about through the transfers. And and then finally, we renamed the program from TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, what it was named in 1996, to be the Jobs and Opportunity with Benefits and Services Act to reflect its purpose and our goal of helping more Americans enter and remain in the workforce.
Okay.
I know that talked really fast, but hopefully...
No, that's really helpful. That's really helpful. Let me underline just a couple things, because in case people aren't familiar. So the WIOA measures, which we all, you know, focused on back in the day, they're really useful because what they are is they really hold programs' feet to the fire to make sure they are doing a bunch of important things, which is getting people jobs, helping people stay on jobs, and seeing, you know, and decent jobs, seeing that the salaries are good. So these are exactly the right measures. And the other thing, just, you know, sort of footnote here, glossary, case management is really important, because I mean, what this means is we're not, they're not, you know, I think a common image is the state just sends you some, you know, rather unprepared person and they sink or swim, and usually they sink. Case management is really the important answer to everybody's in case management. So somebody at the state is, you know, helping make sure they have all the things they need. They're getting that child care. They're getting that help with transportation. They're getting some, you know, sort of coaching to make sure they stay on the job. And I think the other last important thing to point out here, just, you know, from the world of people who follow TANF, is that what Ann said is exactly the problem. You know, the 1996 bill said that states were responsible for getting people to work, and they gave them some money to do it, but a lot of states, you know, just took that money and did other stuff with it, you know, like literally totally unrelated stuff. And the idea that the agency's responsibility to get that person ready for a job and help them stay on the job, states have never really understood that, you know, or you know, bought it or committed to it. You talk to state directors and they think, you know, I don't know what they think their job is, but it's never like really enough about getting them to work. So the bill is very well targeted, is all I'm really trying to say by means of glossary. Why don't we have questions for Anne before we move to Connie? Do people have questions about how the bill works or what its intent is or like that? Okay, don't all speak at once. Who joined us while Anne was talking?
This is Dave Nichols with International Code Council.
Thanks, Dave. Okay, so Anne, do you want to say anything else before we move to Connie?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that this is not a place that everyone necessarily feels comfortable with, but I do want to kind of put out that, you know, if this is something, you know, case management and support for these workers that are trying to come into your organizations is something that you are interested in, you want, you need to let us know. Because we put out a bill, we did a discussion draft, we had a ledge hearing, you know, we had a bunch of witnesses come through. But at the end of the day, you know, our members do need to hear from, you know, you and their other constituents about what is truly needed right now. And if you think the status quo is fine, okay, let us know that too. But I think what Connie is going to point out is that Connie's program receives no state or federal money, and it's awesome. But the question is, hey, we have $30 billion in the system. Why isn't it, you know, doing awesome things like what Connie's doing? And the answer is because the current program is broken and not working. Available
great
for questions. I'm going to send another summary to you tomorrow. CRS did a short 2 pages. Welcome that to you if you could send that out. But we're available for questions and, you know, to do other calls if people think it's necessary.
If you have a minute and you want to stay around for Connie, because there might be questions at the end that you can jump on too. If you're too busy, I totally understand, but you're welcome to stay.
This is what I do. This is our
okay
job.
Okay, Connie. So you're on. So
yes,
tell us. So I'll you know, ask you questions a little bit like a talk show host. Tell us about your amazing. Tell us exactly who you are in the world. I mean, not you personally, but the organization. What is the Home Builders Association of Central Arizona? And then tell us about your program.
Okay. Thank you for having me, by the way. I run a trade association, the Home Builders Association. We've been around since 1951, and like everyone else on the call, you know.
And you're the Arizona, like chapter or something of NAHB,
yeah,
right?
We belong to the National Association of Home Builders, and we service the primarily the Phoenix market. So we are obviously the largest growth market in the state of Arizona, and really don't have a whole lot of access to a lot of labor outside the metropolitan area. So we're kind of an island, unlike some of the other associations in larger metropolitan areas. So, you know, after hearing my board, who's made up of division presidents of the home building companies, talk about labor for the last 3 or 4 years every single month, You know, I did the normal things everybody does. We go to high schools, we do job fairs, went to colleges, even investigated refugee relocation agencies, worked with them for a while. And I can tell you most of my guys, my trade partners were getting their labor from Craigslist. So, you know, that's kind of the landscape of that we were operating under. So I decided.
And what do you get from Craigslist? Like, does that work? I mean, how does, what's, like, I don't know if people are even familiar.
Well,
I mean, the point is it's not satisfactory.
Well,
right?
Probably not the best group of individuals are, you know, on Craigslist.
Right, well, that's what people don't know. That's what I'm asking. So who tends to be, who is it? Who tends to be on? That's what we're not familiar with, right? Because we probably don't, none of us probably use it. What do you get from Craigslist?
You get individuals that are hard to place. I would say you're probably getting more violent ex-offenders. You're probably getting some of those that perhaps had been in for sexual offenses. You know, just those that are more challenging are not probably going to the State Department of Economic Security website for jobs.
Got it. Okay. So that's the predicament. Got it.
Right. So we started, I approached the Department of Corrections and we started going out. I took a group of about 8 trade partners with me and we went out and looked at the programs that were being taught in the various facilities around the state. So I don't know about you guys, but ours are not close to the metropolitan area. So we were traveling about 4 hours to visit any of the correctional facilities. We focused on the minimum security facilities. We focused on those that had construction grade classes going on. What we found after we went there and looked, we were fairly impressed with some of them, so we started doing hiring fairs in the prison for anyone who was getting out within the next 6 months. The reason that this population was so attractive to us was 60% of the population was under the age of 40. An additional 30% of them were under the age of 54. 60% of them also, 63% of them relocating into the Phoenix metropolitan area. So this was a workforce that, or a potential workforce that was very attractive to us. In going and performing the hiring fairs, what we found were there were a lot of people that had worked in the construction trades previously to their incarceration. So again, we were finding some that had a lot of construction experience. Additionally, we were finding a lot of them that were very anxious to work and would be willing to go into some sort of a training program.
Okay, so how does the training program work? Yeah.
So what happened is, in the meantime, we did this for about a year. We hired about 200 individuals out of that particular program. Then our governor set up employment centers. The largest one is right outside of Phoenix, so we had 100. Men that would be put into a facility 60 days prior to their release. Then they partnered, corrections partnered with the Department of Economic Security. They prepared these individuals for work. So they would help them develop a resume. They would practice interview skills. They would give them classes in budgeting, in get their IDs. In Arizona, we are required to e-verify. So it's important that we had their proper documentation to be able to hire them. We also have an employer sanctions law here, so that's very critical that they have their Social Security card and their state ID or a driver's license. So once they had gone through their program, we'd go out there and do hiring fairs out there. When I went out there the second time we went out for a hiring fair, it looked like they had a lot of time on their hands, so I asked corrections if they'd allow us to come in and do some training during that 6 to 8 week time period as they were there. So we piloted 2 training programs, an electrical program and a painting program. Both of them were very successful. We've now moved to a new facility where we'll be doing 6 different trades during that 6 to 8 weeks. And the reason my program is so, I think, successful is it's very employer-centric. So I have one employer for each trade. They provide the instructor. They provide the materials. They provide the curriculum. So they can train 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. They can train 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, whatever they believe will get them to a point where they have some assurance that they're going to be a successful employer once they get out of prison.
Amazing, amazing. So, okay, so let's think about some hard questions, right? So I'm the skeptical employer,
okay.
And I'm saying to myself, oh, this sounds really nice, but that person's going to show up the first day, and the second day they're going to go back home, and somebody's going to say, you know, have a joint or have a hit or whatever people say, and that person is then never going to come back. What about challenges like that? Are these people, how do you handle them? Are they hard workers? Do they stay on the job? You know, have you helped them, and how have the employers dealt with that?
There are no doubt there are challenges to this population, but I think what my employers who participate will tell you is that it is a better group of individuals than they were getting off the street coming to work. So yes, there are going to be some that are not going to show up after, you know, they get their first paycheck or whatever, but I think one of the things that I think distinguishes our program, too, is the employers that work with me have to be willing to work with some of the challenges that come with this particular population. Transportation is a huge issue. Many of them are going into a transitional housing facility, a halfway house. They're on probation for no more than 6 months. So it is difficult sometimes to get them on the job site. Our job sites are not anywhere close to the center of the metropolitan area, so transportation is an issue. They often have a probation officer. We work real hard to have them, our employers know who the probation officer is, have their phone number. They can work together to try to make this individual successful. And those that are really successful have a mentorship for those particular individuals going to work for them. So somebody in the company is mentoring them as they're meeting those challenges.
Yeah, great. I mean, that what you're doing sounds amazing, but also, folks, you know, connect this to what Ann just described. This is what the $30 billion is going to go for. It's going to be helping people have the transportation to get to the jobs, helping sure that they're making sure that they've got the child care so that they're not staying home the first day their kid gets sick. I mean, it's more women than men, obviously, but obviously I think employers are going to have to step up too. Employers who want to hire this population, it's an extra, you probably got to go some extra steps, but the point is state's going to kick in $30 billion to help you. Connie, what am I not asking? What am I not asking? And let's open it to the group. What am I not asking about making this work? From the employer's point of view, you know, what do you hear from your, so what do you, are there any numbers about your employers? Like how many employers are participating?
We have more that participate in the job fairs than participate in the training. I only have room for 6 in the training program, but I probably have 10 that actually come out and do job fairs on a regular basis out at the prison.
And how many people are hiring? How many people are you supplying with employees?
Well, we've hired over 300 since we started the program.
Wow, okay. And how many, do we have any idea, like, how many of them are now, like, still in the business, so to speak?
We track them generally for their first 90 to 120 days. I haven't run those numbers, but I can tell you those that participate in the training program and then get additional training once they get out, the success rate on that is probably upwards of 70%.
Yeah, sounds good, yeah.
So the real key is investing in them so that they feel like they have the support and they have somebody there that has an interest in what they do.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. And these are, you know, a harder population, right, probably. These are prisoners, not just welfare recipients. I mean, I'm sure they're both hard. Is there something more? I mean, I'm sure people are going to have good questions, but before we open it to questions, anything else you want to say?
I think the biggest thing for people to recognize is that you have a population here that's very anxious to work and very anxious to learn. The fact that they had some construction experience and experience in other things as well, but obviously I was, you know, focused on construction. I think is really important. And the gratitude that is expressed by these men and women, and we have hired women as well. I just don't have training programs because the numbers aren't there. The gratitude that they express is just life-changing. Mm-hmm. They go out, and one of the reasons that they recidivate is the fact that they get out of prison. They have a felony conviction, and they have to check that box saying they've committed a felony, and they never get any further than that. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that you're taking, that I'm taking employers in there who understand, they know they have a, they know they have a felony conviction. They're still willing to look at them as a potential employer. You give them hope. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things is they get an opportunity for a second chance.
Amazing. Ann, do you want to add anything in sort of following up on Connie? Like that, you know, I mean, you're in a way a lot of the answer to a lot of the, you know, as you say, she's been providing it with out-state money. You're going to give them state some money to spend on it. But anything else, any other dots you want to connect here?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we learned during our hearing series, like I said, we heard from all industries. So one example is like Daimler Chrysler in Michigan is partnering with the United Way. So they're not only donating to the United Way to help provide these sorts of services, but they're also paying their taxes. So they're, you know, paying twice for these sorts of services. And so, we're seeing that employers value their workers and investing in them. And, you know, we're trying to get them as work ready as we can so that they can get to you guys and you can provide them with their job specific sort of preparation and training on the job. And we're not trying to like push out private sector solutions like Connie has come up with. But we have a program in this country that's supposed to be doing these things and it's clearly not. We're putting a solution out there that we think addresses all of this and, you know, refocuses on work, not only getting a job, but keeping a job. And we think it's better for American families and better for American business and better for the American economy.
That's great. Questions from the folks on the phone?
This is John Rico from State of Illinois. Connie, how long have you been doing this with your state?
A little over 2 years.
Okay. You are aware we are doing it as well in the State of Illinois for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, I'm not sure if you accept inmates from out of state. We have a backlog of over 2,000 inmates from around the country that are asking to go through this program.
Oh, my Lord. I never thought I would arrange this, a phone call for people to, like, range their prisoners, send their prisoners around the country for training. Yeah, go for it.
We have about 275 that are in this facility, and I'm going to train about 60 of them every 8 weeks, so I got plenty of backlog on my own.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, we're the same. Kudos to you. Thank you for that information.
And
but that's really
to
interesting
you.
To the other employers on the phone, too, right, that there is that like there's more people in this pool than you guys can even prepare in a timely way. That's pretty interesting. I mean, for these people, you know, for the other folks on the phone whose members are calling them, you know, every week and saying, I'm desperate for workers, what do I do? Well, hey, there's a whole big pond of workers over there that we can't train fast enough. That's pretty interesting. And now the government is saying, you know, we're going to try to help. Other questions, comments?
Can we talk about liability? Because that's always a big one.
Please.
Just Connie, yeah. You know, I kept hearing from my employers and certainly the general contractors as well about the concern of having ex-offenders on their job site. So
because the point would be that someone would sue, like the homeowner or somebody would sue? Who was going to
sue?
Well,
something would happen on a job site that would involve an ex-offender and to the extent that you can immunize those employers from being sued solely for hiring an ex-offender, you certainly want to be able to do that.
And who would sue them? Just who would sue them, so I understand it?
Well, if somebody burglarized a homeowner's house or something that happened in the neighborhood, we are putting these ex-offenders in neighborhoods where there are existing families.
So
even though we do not hire violent offenders, we do not hire sex offenders, none of them get in our program, the reality of it is, some of them, most of these gentlemen and ladies were in for some drug-related offense. So if they go back on drugs or anything, there is that liability issue. So we passed a bill this year in our legislature that went a long way towards immunizing the employers from being sued solely for hiring that ex-offender. There are six other states that have similar laws. Colorado, Minnesota, North Carolina, Ohio, Tennessee, and Texas.
Minnesota, Ohio, Tennessee, Texas. What's the missed one?
North Carolina. Yeah, that's what.
So if you don't work in one of those states, what do you do? So, like, I mean,
you push for legislation.
You push for it. Yeah. So, but with Hannah's people, it's going to be a little less of an issue. Do you anticipate anything, is that a need? Are you, does that even come up on your radar?
On my radar?
And.
Are you asking someone else?
So that sort of liability, it's being handled at the state level.
Yeah.
And would involve our judiciary committee. So
Right. And it's probably less of an issue for the people you're going to try to help, right? For TAN people.
Yeah.
I mean, somewhat of an issue, but a little less.
Yeah, but it certainly comes up, and I think that states could certainly use the money too, to help address some of those things. So a state could enact legislation similar to what Connie was referencing. And then sometimes there's fees or things like that need to be paid or whatnot. All of those can be paid for with TANF dollars. In fact, they can actually be paid for with SNAP employment and training dollars too. There's lots of different ways. And so, sometimes you need legislation to get, some protections, but also thinking about just like all those ancillary things that a worker might need to get into and remain in the workforce.
So are we going to stop calling this TANF? I mean, TANF is like a word in the vocabulary now. Are we going to start to talk about jobs dollars?
Yeah, that's Chairman Brady's vision.
Wow.
We want to be committed to what it is this program is about, and that's jobs.
Questions from the people on the phone? So, Anne, you're going to have a markup tomorrow, and then what's going to happen? Is this going to get to the floor? What's going on in the Senate?
Sure. So a markup is where the committee considers legislation. Our members openly debate it.
We know that.
The Democrats will probably offer some amendments. But we think that there's some common ground here. At least we felt that way during our hearing series.
So you think this will be bipartisan? You think it'll get the vote?
I don't think the markup itself will be bipartisan. But I think there is stuff in here. And this is a play that we've kind of run before with HR subcommittee where we kind of like put out an opening offer and we say like, hey, here's what we're thinking. And, we want to hear from people whether this is a good direction or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't hear from people and we don't get anything, then the whole process just stops. But if we hear encouragement, if we hear like, hey, I like the idea of, supporting workers because, given where we are with the unemployment rate and things like that, we have struggled with employees and, could use the additional support. We keep going. The Senate is also working on some stuff. We're all kind of like in this space. But we're looking for some outside direction of, what people think they need and what they like about what it is we're trying to do.
Right. What I'm fishing for here is what's going to happen this, is this going to get to the floor? Is this going to come out of committee at some point? Is it going to get to the floor?
So the program expires in September, And so that's what we are, so this bill is a 5-year reauthorization. And so we do, we have to take committee and congressional action on this. So yeah, we'll get it out of committee. We'll take it to the floor. And then the Senate usually doesn't do things publicly, but, you know, they're working on some stuff. And, you know, we've been very successful in the subcommittee this year. I just want to highlight a few of the other things that folks may not be aware of, which is we did home visiting, which you may not think applies to you, but it works with mothers in the first 2 years of a baby's life to help them get self-sufficient, get back into the workforce, and help, you know, raise that child to be a strong person, ready for school. We also, what else did we do? Oh, we did substance abuse, mental health, and parenting in the child welfare program, so recognizing the needs there to strengthen families, which also strengthens workers. You know, we've been very bipartisan in the unemployment insurance space. We also put in money for reemployment services for people who have lost their jobs who are labor force attached. So what we're talking about in TANF are people who are not labor force attached, but those that have a job and lose a job go through our through no fault of their own, go through our unemployment insurance system. So we put some money in there for reemployment. And all of that has been bipartisan. And so that's how we operate, how we get stuff done. People don't believe that it happens. But sometimes when you have, when you can fly below the radar, you can really get a lot done. So,
right. But and the September reauthorization, like if you don't, if you don't reauthorize it, the money stops, so you have to reauthorize it? It's not like...
Yeah,
like
so the money stops. Yep.
Okay, so,
so
you have to get it done. Yeah, got it. Yep. Yep. Got it. Okay,
Mark,
this is...
Can I ask Anna a question?
Please.
This is Connie. And does this in any way affect the work opportunity tax credit?
It does not. Well, so individuals who receive TANF are eligible for WOTC. It's one of the categories of people. So it doesn't change their ability to get that.
Why don't you explain that in sort of 25 words or less to the people on the call?
So the Work Opportunity Tax Credit is for employers who hire, and there's like a list of like 8 different kind of in-need categories of people, so TANF recipients, food stamp recipients, veterans in certain categories, you know, and it includes...
Ex-offenders.
Yeah.
And so how much money is it and how complicated is it? So you're not just going to spend $30 billion to train these people. You're actually going to give me a tax credit when I hire the guy?
That's
how much and how much and how much money is it and how cumbersome is it to get it?
That's a great question.
It's up to $2,400 they have to be hired within the first year. The ex-offenders have to be hired within their first year of release. I'm not sure about the other population.
Got it. So you're going to get a, you know, a work-ready worker, and you're going to get a $2,400 tax credit. Fascinating.
Per worker, right.
That could add up. Got it. Everybody's, the folks on the phone are quiet. I'm sure people are learning a lot. Haven't heard anyone hang up. And I'm eager to, to encourage my coalition to be supportive and let other members know that this would be something that, you know, could only help, though unproven could only help. But we won't talk about that while you're on with us, Anne.
Okay.
Yep, that was Paul, my coalition's person here, is making sure I don't get into trouble.
So
the only thing that I would say on that is that as this legislation moves through the House, our Ways and Means members are pretty well versed on the policy, on its impact, but I wouldn't say the same thing for off-committee members.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we go to them and have the policy discussion, it's really helpful to have statements and letters from outside groups discussing how the policy will actually work in the real world. So,
we'll put
down the Ways and Means document in front of them and say, you know, here's the policy and here's how this works. And it's also helpful to give them other papers from outside groups that say, hey, here's how this is going to work in the real world.
Yeah, got it. And so, I mean, we might have less of that because I don't know how many people in, you know, we'll have to figure out, like in the Associated Builders and Contractors and Associated General Contractors are already doing this stuff. But I can imagine that we would say we need, you know, we're desperate for workers and we'd be eager to, you know, have these people show up. I don't know that we can give examples of how it already works, but
Just discussion of here's what we would do with it.
And so are you also telling me that the most useful letter would not actually go to the committee, but would go to all members, or do we send it to the committee anyway? What are you giving?
Definitely to the committee. I mean, you can address it to, you know, the general, to either Chairman Brady and, you know, or like a general dear member of Congress.
Yeah.
But definitely send it to us. And then when we're going around and having this,
you'll use it. Got it.
We have it as a handout that we put in front of them.
Definitely,
if you have the ability to send it directly to the member office, that's great also, but definitely it's helpful for us to see those.
Got it. No, of course, you'd see it. Yeah, of course. Okay, cool. Other questions? Did someone just join or someone, well, you don't, if someone joined, let us know who you are. Other questions from folks on the call? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Connie, and thank you very much, Anne. This was incredibly useful. I'm sure people are interested, and we'll be back in touch soon.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone who from the coalition who was on the call.
Thank you.